Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Café Scientifique. My name is Zachary Weber. I am the Education Coordinator of Adult Programs here at the Science Center. So I'd just like to welcome you here tonight. Our speaker tonight is Dr. John A. Pollock. Dr. Pollock is a graduate of Syracuse University with a Bachelor of Science in Physics and in Philosophy, and a Master's of Science in Physics and a PhD in Biophysics. During his time at Caltech in Pasadena, California, Dr. Pollock established a research program that focused on studying the developmental biology of the nervous system, work that he continues today. After nearly 6 years at Caltech, Dr. Pollock moved to Carnegie Mellon University in 1989 to serve as assistant, then associate professor of biological sciences and director of graduate programs. In 2001, Dr. Pollock moved his research laboratory to Duquesne University to serve as an associate professor of biological sciences. At Duquesne University, he has continued his research on neural development and has initiated a new basic science research program investigating chronic pain. Another dimension of Dr. Pollock's work has been development of a broad collection of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and health literacy teaching resources for children and the general public that are used in museums, schools, and broadcast television. His scholarly work on the assessment and evaluation of these pieces explores how people learn from multimedia. Please join me in welcoming Dr. John Pollock.
Thank you, Zach. Let's see, is this microphone on for you guys? Can you all hear me well? It's a little low. I'll move it up. That should do it. Well, I could do the volume, or I could move the mic closer to my mouth. I'm going to tell stories. I'm going to tell two main stories, and the stories are from the point of view of the work that I do. And when I'm talking about pain, I have to make clear right off the bat, as you just heard, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a guy who studies the basic biology of how things work, and that's what I'll be telling you about today. So if you have medical questions, I might be able to give you an opinion that's based on the same kind of knowledge that your next-door neighbor might have. So talk to a real doctor if you have real doctor-type questions. In addition to being at Duquesne University, I'm co-director of the Chronic Pain Research Consortium. That's a group of scientists, 20 scientists at Duquesne University, who are all ganging together with their different expertise to look at ways to study different aspects of how pain happens, how it works, and what the biology is, with the goal of developing basic tools that can ultimately be applied to clinical studies in the future. The work at Duquesne University, I do have a little laser pointer, is being supported right now from the funds from the Pittsburgh Tissue Engineering Initiative, Duquesne University, and a couple other small grants. So we're going to start off with a textbook view of a little bit of neuroscience. We all know that the brain is connected to our spinal cord, and the spinal cord has a bunch of little itty-bitty segments. We know that because we've all seen skeletons, and the skeleton has all those different vertebrae. Those are segments of our body. And the nervous system here is paying attention to what are called dermatomes, areas of the body's surface which are spread out, and what kind of looks like a weird chaotic pattern across the body. But if we go back to the way we used to be quadrupeds. And there, the model of dermatome presentation makes a lot of sense and how things are mapped out across the body. So we're going to keep that in mind a little bit because we're going to end up looking at some neural structures that are down here in the lumbar region later on. The second bit of neuroscience from the textbook that we want to look at is some of what's going on in the skin. In our skin, we've got a whole bunch of different types of sensor cells. We've got touch pressure sensor cells, deep vibration sensor cells here down in the deeper layers of the skin, stretch sensors that tells when our skin's being stretched, other touch sensors, and different types of pain sensors. All these sensors are in your skin to collect information about what it is that's touching you or what you're touching, and are brought to bear in a lot of different ways. That information in your skin is sent into cells that sit here in this, what's called dorsal root ganglion. It's a bunch of cell bodies that are sitting just outside the spinal cord. And here's a cartoon view of our long spinal cord with all the dorsal root ganglion lined up along the whole length. And for this cartoon from my textbook that I teach from, we're looking at that dermatome that corresponds to your fingers, and that's how we see that this receptor nerve ending is following through to a cell body that's sitting right here. I'm going to talk about these same types of dorsal root ganglion, but they're going to be down here in the lumbar region. Here's a slightly larger view of that picture. So again, we've got these receptor endings out in the periphery, out in our skin, and that has the actual cell body, the nucleus, sitting here in this ganglion. I don't do any research past this point. Other researchers at Duquesne University and all around the world do a lot of work looking at the spinal cord and also what's going on in the brain. So when we talk about pain, we're going to talk about how that pain sensation is first being perceived, and then it's up to the rest of the nervous system, the spinal cord and the brain, to make an interpretation of that information. So I'm going to look at a protein and a gene called TRP. TRPs are proteins, or calcium channels, and they allow the cells, these peripheral neurons, to sense the world. We have about 30 different TRP genes in our body that encode these TRP proteins. And here's a cartoon that looks at six of them. We've got TRPA1, M8, and TRPs 1, 2, 3, and 4 over here. You see, these TRP proteins are there to sense temperature. This morning, I grabbed onto my coffee cup and started walking across the room, and at first I knew that it was warm. My TRPV4 kicked in, and a step later I realized that it was kind of warm. TRPV3 kicked in, and a moment later I realized that it was too hot to hold, and I'm looking for a place to put the cup down. And that was my TRPA1, A2 kicking in. And similarly, we've got ones that pay attention to cold, and cold that's so painful, like when you're scraping the ice off the windshield of your car like we did so much this winter without gloves on. But the neat thing is, the really cool thing is, right here we've got TRPM8 that pays attention to cold temperature. All of you have seen the commercial and probably experienced the opportunity of popping that mint or chew gum in your mouth and sensing that cool, refreshing blast. If you feel that coldness in your mouth because you're chewing on that menthol gum, if you stuck a thermometer in there, it would be the same temperature as it always is. It's not going to be cold. It feels cold because the menthol in the spearmint has activated this same protein that senses cold. And the protein can't tell the difference. It knows to respond. It thinks it's cold, but it's actually just been activated by this chemical. The same thing happens over here with our TRPV1 and V2. They're activated by capsaicin, hot, spicy peppers. You take a bite of that hot, spicy pepper and you feel your mouth burning. It's not any hotter. It's physically still 98.6 or thereabouts. And it's that spice is activating that same protein. So these proteins are very multidimensional in the way that they can work for us. So how do TRPs relate to pain? We have a pretty limited repertoire of pain analgesics that we get to work with. By and large, we have two categories most people would think of, that we have these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Aspirin is a good example, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, Tylenol. Or very powerful drugs that you need to go see your doctor to get. Either one of these classes are drugs that are broadcast through your whole body. You take the medicine, and it's going to go everywhere in your body. And that's how they work. And it's a good thing. They do a really good job of what they're supposed to do. The thing is, though, a lot of times these medicines don't always produce the effect that we need. For people who are in chronic pain, they just don't cut the mustard for them. And there really is a need for development of new medicines, without a doubt. But you see, the way I look at it is because we see these TRP proteins having all these different functions, and there's so many other TRPs out there in the body, the way I look at it is, gosh, I think we've been sort of hoodwinked by the aspirin and ibuprofen companies. I mean, the advertisement says that medicine's going to solve everything. It's going to work for your headache, it's going to work for your toothache, it's going to work for the sunburn, it's going to work for your broken pinky, it's going to work for everything. And they do. And that makes us think that all pain is the same, when in fact, every pain is different. And if you think about it for a second, each pain that you have feels a little different. A toothache feels different than a sunburn. A toothache feels different than a broken bone. I broke my pinky playing soccer with my son. So all these things feel different, and they feel different because they're being encoded by different proteins. So why don't we make pain medicines that are pain-specific, that go for just that one protein and take that one pain out of action and leave the rest of the body alone? So that's my goal. And to get there, given that there are different pain sensations and they're detected by different proteins, could we make pain-specific analgesics? And the first step to going there is to develop a much deeper understanding about pain and how it is sensed by the body in the first place. And for that, we use laboratory animals to help develop the knowledge that's needed to take this next step. So we're doing an experiment with rats where we create chronic pain. We expose the sciatic nerve in the rat, tie four little ligatures around that nerve, stitch the animal back up. And here's the animals. They're in a little cage. We're looking from below because what we can do with these guys is for the leg that's affected, this right leg, we can poke the foot. Now, all of you have had some type of injury. Maybe you burn your hand on the stove. And you know every time you come near heat, you feel that pain. You feel that extra heat. And if the burn wasn't there, you wouldn't react at all. It would be perfectly fine. That's a sensitization that's happened because of the injury. So the same thing's going on with the rat, that because of the ligatures, the foot is sensitized. And we can measure that based on the animal's behavior by tapping the foot. A normal animal doesn't care about being tapped. The animals that get a sham surgery is where you do all the same surgery, but you don't tie the ligatures on the sciatic nerve. So it's just like a basic surgery. They're sensitized a little bit, and you would be too if you had surgery. But these chronic constriction injury animals, these ones that are in pain, they have a highly sensitized response. And this is at day 8 after the operation. By day 11 after the operation, the sham animals, like you or I, have recovered from the surgery. They're pretty much back to normal, whereas these ones that have this chronic pain are exhibiting chronic pain. They're still sensitized. So this demonstrates that we can discretely measure the pain sensitivity in the rat. And then we go into some molecular biology. What we're demonstrating here is that we can look at these TRIP genes that I just told you about and see that their expression is elevated in the CCI condition. And other genes have their expression pattern. There's more RNA being expressed in these cells as a result of this insult and injury. And the back of the mind question keeps coming back to why? What's going on in these cells that tells these cells to express more of this RNA? And as I'm sure you all know, in the nucleus, you've got your DNA, the DNA makes RNA, and the way the cell actually does its business relies on proteins. So the next step for the cell is to make a protein from these RNAs. And here's an experiment that demonstrates that the TRIP proteins are also elevated in their expression. This is actually a pretty cool experiment. What we've done is we've injected into the foot pad a dye that's going to stick on the sensory neurons. And that dye is going to go up just all the way along the nerve fiber, all the way up to the dorsal root ganglion next to the spinal cord. And here we are looking in the dorsal root ganglion at 5 cells, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Those 5 cells all have the dye. This is in the dorsal root ganglion up by the spinal cord, and they have the dye because we injected it in the foot pad. And we know that these 5 cells are neurons because they have the neurofilament protein expressed in them. So here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I took this picture and overlaid them so that you can be convinced that those 5 cells are neurons and they have this retrograde dye in them. There's another neuron sitting right here by this asterisk. And here's the asterisk, and that cell is not labeled. It doesn't have the retrograde dye coming from the foot pad. But the neat thing is, all 5 of these neurons that innervate all the way down to the foot pad and are some of the neurons that are sensitized as a result of this injury, they all express high levels of the TRIP protein. So we've gone through a process like this to measure how much protein is in the animals that have the pain and how much protein is in the animals that don't have pain, and we see that the animals that have pain always have more protein relative to the DID signal as compared to the ones that are the control animals. So what does this mean? It means that we now have ways that we can measure pain in several different aspects of the biology of pain. So what we need is a new approach. We need a new thing that we can do to better understand how and why these changes are taking place in the animal. So the new approach comes from a collaboration that I started about 2.5 years ago with this woman, Yelena Janich. And what we did in this experiment relies on her work making nanoparticles. She makes little itty-bitty droplets, nanoparticles, that carry a fluorescent tag and also carry a tag, a molecule that we can see by MRI. And we've taken those particles, they're about 140 nanometers across, and fed them to macrophages in culture. And we can see them here, these little spots. They're very faint in this channel right here. And they're also the little black spots that you can see over here. But the macrophages eat up these particles and become labeled. This is a 3D picture of a cell. And what this would show you is that the particles are actually all throughout the depth of the cell. They're not accumulating on the outside of the cell. They're not stacked up on the surface. They're actually been eaten and consumed by the cells. Now, why do we care? We care because that this dye is something that we can feed these immune cells that are in your own body. And we do that here with the rat. So here's a live animal. These guys are anesthetized, and we're taking pictures of them. We've injected into them these nanoparticles, and the rat's own immune cells, its own resident macrophages, have said, what the heck? What is this nanoparticle doing here? And they eat them up. They take them out of action and package them inside the macrophage. And then the macrophage goes on about its business. And one of the things the macrophage needs to do is go to the site of pain, go to the inflammation that we've induced. So here's the animal that's the chronic constriction injury animal, and it's the only one that has this strong signal right here on the thigh, right where we did the put the injury. Here's another example of the experiment. Here's the sham surgery, and we see a little bit of inflammation on the wound, and this is at day 11 post-surgery. But for this same animal, the animal's alive when we take the picture. It's just slightly anesthetized. We wake it up. It goes about its business for a couple more days. We take another picture here, and that surgical wound inflammation is almost completely resolved. But in animals that were studied at the same time, here's the day 11 inflammation that we see for the sciatic nerve. And here it is still persisting in the chronic pain state a couple days later. So here's the advantage here is that we can label these macrophages, and then find where the pain happens. Now, let's imagine I go to the doctor. I say, my foot hurts. And the doctor looks at my foot, and there's nothing wrong with my foot. He says, well, there's got to be something wrong somewhere between your foot and your lower back. But I don't know where the problem is. So in the future, I might be able to get an injection of this type of nanoparticle and lie down on the imaging bed, and they'll find out, oh, you've got a pinched nerve in your thigh. Oh, maybe the pinched nerve is in my lower back. I can find out precisely where the injury is without having to do nerve biopsies or other invasive techniques. You can see exactly where the pain is inside the body. Now, to demonstrate this a little further, here's that same animal and our control on top. We can recover the sciatic nerves from these animals, and the sciatic nerve itself is highly labeled here and not labeled in our control experiments. And then, remember I mentioned there was a second dye that we have going on here. That second dye is the fluorine 19 that shows up as this little spike here in this NMR spectra. And that's a boring picture for me. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that love spectra like that. My dad is one of them. But I like to see the actual thing in the animal. So we're going to do that because you all know that MRI can let you see inside the body. So here's the MRI of the rat's thigh. Here's a right nearby section in the thigh. So here's the femur, and this is the knee at the top. And the white line right here is the sciatic nerve. And just one section a little way from there, here's the knee again up here. Here's the white line of the sciatic nerve. And those four gray blobs, those are the four knots that we tied on the sciatic nerve to induce the discomfort in the first place. And when I look at this is just a regular proton image of MRI. When I look at where the fluorine is, all the fluorine is right there on the knots. And the fluorine got there because the fluorine got into the macrophages, and it's the macrophages that have carried this signal to this place in the animal. And when we look inside the nerve, we see that indeed macrophages, these green spots are an antibody staining for macrophages, they're in the nerve. So what's next? What this has told us is that part of the pain process is actually an interplay between immune cells that are trying to do the right thing and the nervous system. and that the dialogue they've created has created a problem that's leading to this chronic pain. So what's next is to see if drugs can influence the inflammation, because these really nifty nanoparticles that Yelena builds are really multipurpose. We can not only put different labels inside the nanoparticle, we can put drugs inside the nanoparticle. So when we do that, here's the behavioral test done in a slightly different way. We're testing over time, so the sham animals show that there's really no increased sensitivity. Here's the animal that got the CCI condition, and you're seeing that it's getting more and more sensitive as time goes on. And what we're going to do is at day 8, we're going to take a population of animals and give them a single injection of the nanoemulsion carrying a very low dose of a drug. And by giving that one dose right here, within 2 days, those guys are running around just like the sham animals. They're not feeling pain anymore. Now, this is brand new, unpublished data, but we have statistical significance, Sam, in the analysis here. So we believe that this is what's going on. But this is very cool. This is telling us that we can take a drug and deliver it precisely to where the injury is and have an immediate effect on pain. The same drug has been used in animals in the same treatment to resolve pain. But when they do it the conventional way of giving it by mouth, they have to give, over the course of 10 days, about 2,000-fold more drug than we gave in this single injection right here. So this is a really cool thing about new ways of delivering drug in a targeted way. So let me recap with what we have learned about this. We've learned that we can measure changes in the behavior and physiology of animals in ways that represent pain, that we can label nanoparticles that can be used to visualize in the live animals the inflammation associated with this chronic pain, and that loading the nanoparticles with drugs successfully delivers the drug to the site of inflammation and relieves pain. So we're really excited about these technologies. And the materials that we're working with are materials that can and have a very reasonable chance of being validated for human use. But as you always hear on the TV and radio news stories, it's years in the future. So something that we can stay tuned to in years to come. If you have questions about the research, education, treatment, advocacy for pain, there's a lot of really good web pages that have tutorials, information, even access to clinical trials. So the NIH Pain Consortium is a great one, American Pain Society, American Chronic Pain Association, and the American Academy of Pain Medicine. So these are places to go if you have other questions about human conditions. So we're going to make a transition now. We're going to go on to story 2. And story 2 has to go back to how I've begun to learn a little bit of how we learn. And in this case, I'm now putting on my hat of being the director of the Partnership in Education, and this has been facilitated by continuing collaborations at Carnegie Mellon University in the Entertainment Technology Center, and also work that I'm doing with Planet Earth Television. And this is my sort of NASCAR view of, these are a lot of my sponsors that have helped me to do the work that I'm doing in this regard. So first I want to tell you my motivation. I'm a scientist. I'm busy in the lab doing this basic science research. I have students that I'm teaching. I have courses that I'm teaching. And yet, I want to do these other things too. So I've got a motivation for why I want to bring these ideas out to the public. And it has to do with the fact that there's a problem. And I think we can incrementally begin to find a solution to that problem. And I also want to tell you a little bit about why I think telling stories really matters, and how you can use the stories to focus on fundamental principles. And one of the most important things, which was actually a real trick for tonight, is knowing the audience, knowing who you're talking to and how you need to package what it is what you want to say. So my motivation goes to the fact that there seems to be a problem. And if we think about science literacy in our country, we also understand that science literacy impacts health literacy, how well you can communicate to your doctor is actually in part how well you understand some of the science that your doctor is thinking about. There's a whole lot of government reports and things out in the public press about how unscientific America is and how this leads to a lot of challenges and problems. Some of the data that you've probably heard of, which I'll touch on real briefly, is there's this great international study, Programme International, that assesses 15-year-olds on their abilities in science, math, reading. You say, well, I'm not a 15-year-old. Well, in 5 years' time, these 15-year-olds are adults. So this is a snapshot view of how well we're doing as a nation compared to a lot of other nations. And the problem here is, I know you can't read all the countries here, but you can see the United States is in the middle of the pack. We're not at the top in science and how we're training kids in science. We're actually below average in math, and we're kind of just a nudge below average on reading. Now, I care about reading a lot because reading is a great way to understand the world at your own pace. But the National Adult Literacy Survey tells us, you can't quite see it because I put it in white for some silly reason, there's about 70, maybe 80 million people who are in this category of below basic or nearly below basic in their reading ability. Well, that's a problem. And actually, other studies put the number closer to about 100 million adults can't read effectively. And it's a challenging test. It's like reading your bank statement and knowing what it really means, or getting a bus schedule and being able to figure that out. It's simple things like reading the newspaper and knowing that the A2 at the bottom of the column means that the story continues on the next page. But there's a lot of people who they can read the words and they can understand some of it, but they can't quite put it all together in context. We also know that only about 20% of the population could read the Tuesday edition of the New York Times or watch a Nova show front to back and really get what's going on there. Another way of looking at this in the national study was a health literacy, and we see that across all the different ethnicities in our country, there's a variation in health literacy that ranges pretty dramatically. But if I look just at the folks in this top category who are below basic, on health literacy, some of those people are actually scoring very high in prose or intermediate or even proficient in reading prose or reading documents or even quantitative. So it's actually a very complex story, and the health literacy and science literacy intermingle across all demographics, across all races and income levels. Now, one last piece of information. Over 61% of the population, this is a study from a few years ago in Pew, look up health literacy information online. And you know, that's a good thing. It ain't what you know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. That's attributed to Mark Twain. And when you just look up something on the web, you're going to get a piece of information. And if you believe that, gosh, I hope you've gone to a verifiable, good source where what they're telling you is really true. And that's part of the trick. So for me, the process goes back to telling stories. And I want to let you know why I think storytelling really matters. And so for that, we need a little history. Well, a lot of history. We're going to go back 1.5 million years to one of our ancient ancestors. This guy is a Scientific American view of Homo erectus. Pretty neat. Stone tools, pointy sticks, really pretty sophisticated hunter. So much so that their diet was shifting over to a pretty high protein diet, allowing their teeth and jaws to get a bit smaller. They had really high quality tools. They also had this. Our ancient ancestors, so 1 million years or so ago, had campfires. What do you do when you're around a campfire? Cook s'mores, tell stories, sing songs, tell ghost stories. I think this is one of the key things in human evolution. Not just because it let us start eating a high-protein diet and being much more efficient about digesting it, but because it put us in that circle around the fire where we felt warm, we felt safe, we felt comfortable. And even though these ancient ancestors, no way were they talking like you and I. They didn't have the voice box that you and I have. But they had the opportunity to pantomime, to tell stories, to find a way to communicate one to another, to share the things that happened that day, where they found good food, where they found danger, how to build a better sharpening edge, how to build a sharper point on that stick. They started communicating and telling stories. So it's that storytelling that I think was one of the key events in our overall evolution. Humans have been telling stories, I think, for a very long time, perhaps a million years. And for that, humans love a good story. Something that we've been doing for that long is something that's going to be hardwired in our brain. So on the sweep of human history, what's next? We started doing art. But this is only 50,000 years ago. This is really pretty recent stuff. And here we're showing our legacy, our storytelling, now in a much more graphical and much more permanent way. I have no doubt that people were drawing in the sand and painting on skins and had artifactual storytelling like this before they got around to pinning it on rocks that we could find today. But this is the forebearer of written language, which really didn't even get a start until stuff like this. We had after the flood, the Black Sea got overflowed with water. We ended up with this age of invention. New challenges were coming to human population. And people were getting good about putting information down on here, the tablet. One of the very old tablet, we knew what to write down first. I always find that important. And then the next step in my mind is René Descartes. Now, René Descartes was one of the people in the Age of Invention, Age of Enlightenment, who was writing down how to be a scientist and what you needed to do to be a good scientist, that you needed to do experiments, that you needed to have a hypothesis, that you needed to actually try things out, unlike the Greeks. So, with a million years of evolution, I think our brains are really good to telling and listening to stories. We're not necessarily wired to read. We actually have to learn how to read. And even reading, as you know, isn't something that people started doing en masse until a few hundred years ago at best, and more or less about 200 years ago. And we're definitely not hardwired to think about science and health. This is really new stuff. This is Sputnik age on that we're thinking about science. And we're not wired. We have to learn and try and work at this type of stuff. So what do I do? What do we want to do about this? We want to tell stories with great visuals that are scientifically accurate. We want to follow the content of the story that carries fundamental principles that are really linked to something that's important and relatable to the audience that you're talking to. And then you want to reinforce the message as much as you can through as many different media engagements as possible. So let me give you one example. I'm probably going to give you more than one example. We'll take this example for starts. Kids who get heart transplants, a significant portion of them die because they stop taking their medicine. And here the numbers are 32% for kidney and 31% of the recipients for liver. The kidney and liver kids tend to survive because when they stop taking their medicines and they go into organ rejection, they start feeling like crap. Because the liver's not working right or the kidney's not working right, and they go back on the medicine. But if it's a heart transplant, you don't know when your heart's going to stop working, and the kids die. And when I heard that, I said, oh, my goodness, if my kid needed the medicine for a heart transplant, I'd make sure on the hour the doctor said they're going to have the medicine. And that's great when they're 8 years old. It doesn't work when they're 17. When they're 17, they have to start taking over that. So when they go to college, they're able to do that. Studies have also demonstrated that when kids understand why they need the medicine, what it's actually doing for their body, they're actually much better at working with it. So to really understand the medicine, you needed to understand a whole lot of biology and all sorts of weird stuff. What we thought we could do is actually, in a crash course way, help kids get a handle on this. So we took the brochure that the children at Children's Hospital were getting, let me move on here, and turned it into a comic book. So here's a kid looking at the comic book about the heart transplant. And it's written in a way with pretty pictures and stories. We actually fabricated these books with big open spaces and questions, asking the kids to annotate the book, to tell us where they liked the stories we were telling, and tell us the stuff that they thought was really lame, and tell us the questions that they had that we weren't answering. Things that we wanted to animate, we put into these little pockets with little like flip book things that they could play with and engage. And we took that information back and turned it into a little video that they could play on an iPad, they could watch anywhere. And by doing this, by making it more accessible to them, putting it into a language that they appreciate and valued, we found that there was significant changes in their understanding. Here, for example, where's my mouse? I'm not getting there. Item number 9 over there, where we have a really dramatic change in performance. This is out too. That was a question where the kids had asked us to tell them why they need biopsies. They need to get biopsies all the time. They have to go under anesthesia. They're shoving a catheter down their vein into their heart. They're taking out a piece of tissue. The kids want to know, why do we need to do this? So we told them why. And they now understand it. The one category, number 3, where we actually went down, was a question that we intentionally didn't address. And the question was, why do you need a heart transplant? I didn't try to answer that because it's personalized. Why one kid needs a heart transplant is completely different than why somebody else needed a heart transplant. So we didn't go there with that. We also built some video games on the immune system. And there we go. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit for the sake of time and just show you one fun point. One of our first video games was looking at how you get infections from a splinter. I work in the garden. I get thorns and splinters and little infections all the time, so I thought that would be a good thing. So we did testing with the kids on that study. We found that the game needed to be progressively more difficult. They really wanted more complex objectives, and the children who did the testing with us very politely said that a splinter is really boring. So we gave up on the splinter, and we went back to the kids and started working with them on another way to talk about infections. And I really wanted the kids to get engaged in a story about infections that would matter to them, that they would pay attention to. And these are adolescents. I mean, what infection does a teenager really need to know about and want to pay attention to? And we finally struck on it. And the idea was actually enlightened by a story that some of the kids told us. Here the story is that Benny wants to go to the dance, but his date says, no way, your face looks like a pizza. I'm not going to go until your acne is cleaned up. So the story is an infection that goes on with skin. And that was great because it lets us talk about a lot of different aspects of skin biology and infections and viral diseases and all sorts of good stuff. We also know that sometimes you don't want a video game, that you want kids to play at a different pace, so we turned the game into a board game, and that was useful. In another study, we asked, actually done here at the Carnegie Science Center, we produced 2 different planetarium shows, one where we have animated characters, Dr. Leavable and her sidekick friend, Regina Robot, talking about tissue engineering, and the other was sort of like a planetarium show where you got pretty pictures on the dome and a voice is coming out of the heavens talking to you. And we asked the kids how well they learned from watching the films, and the kids learned a lot. We found that they dramatically improved, and this is a test before and then a test after, a dramatic improvement in how well they learned for what a stem cell was, that there's blood in your bones. But one of the neat things that we did is we asked the kids to draw pictures of things before they saw the movie and then after they saw the movie. And here, this is what I really like about it. The kids come away with a visual understanding of how things work, and that they can render that, they can draw a picture of that. And you see, I think that's important because you're going to mess up vocabulary. No matter, you might learn a word today and 2 weeks from now or a month from now, it's going to get muddled unless you use it a lot. Whereas a mental image, an ability to draw a picture of something, that's probably going to stick a long time. The next story that I want to tell you briefly is how we tackle the spiral of life. We did stories on evolution, and we broached that in a variety of different ways. We made a planetarium show. Upstairs in the museum, there's a synthetic interview with Charles Darwin that we did a couple of different studies on. We wanted a visual icon for the tree of life. We wanted to be able to do something that we could use in a variety of different museums and locales. Darwin himself drew this picture in his notebook in 1837 that's representing how species can differentiate over time. And we took that idea through a bunch of different concepts. This whole story is published in a peer-reviewed paper for Sam in a journal called Leonardo. And I'm really tickled by the fact that it's sustaining itself. When a paper was published, it was one of the highest read papers out of Leonardo for 2012. And now every year since then, it's still one of the top 5 most read papers out of the journal. So it's free. By all means, go look for that. But it tells the story of how we made these different murals, many of which are still around town. This one is upstairs in this museum. This one was at the Botanical Gardens at the Phipps. That was just a temporary exhibit. This one's still at the zoo in the Discovery Room. And this is an interactive device. The children are given the goal of either drawing a picture of an animal they like or inventing an animal, and then finding where on the tree of life their animal goes. And if they invent an animal, that's great, because then they have to go through the whole process to see if it's got wings or feathers or scales or whatever. And the one at the aviary is still in use.
You break a bone. Does it heal on its own, or is it damaged forever?
Blood cells have a job that's special. They're inside bones and blood vessels.
Join Leah and her quirky brother Axel on a science adventure filled with singing, dancing, and discovery.
Birds are descended from dinosaurs. We also know from watching living birds that they heal very quickly.
It's Scientastic.
So Scientastic is a TV show that we produced as a pilot back in 2010 that was broadcast on WQED. The website is still there. And that was a process that sort of let me bridge into a new environment of storytelling. Along with Scientastic, we built an app because I wanted to tell more stories about bones. And we did this really as a test. The Scientastic TV show has gone through a rigorous study. We plan to publish that later this year. But part of that was also building an app that lets you explore bones in more detail. So here on the iPad app, and this is available for free, Powers of Minus 10 Bone, you can zoom in onto the structures in bones and see the cells that make up bone and poke at cells, and it will tell you whether it's an osteoclast or osteoblast and a little bit about what they're doing. One of the fun things with the app is it also lets you break a bone and see how it heals. We had the huge advantage that Apple liked it and promoted it on their new and noteworthy site. And in part because of that, we ended up with about 600,000 downloads of the app in the first 6 months. We have a new Scientastic TV show, which I won't play the music for right now, because I'm going to talk. It's going to premiere on WQED on Sunday, April 6th, and again on April 13th, so you can watch for it there. It's an hour-long special for kids and families about why you need to sleep and why nobody's getting enough. The Scientastic Project has also broadened into doing some community outreach work. We're working last summer in Hazelwood with Tim Smith, doing some science education with the kids that were there. So we still have a population where we have low reading skills, low math skills, problem-solving skills, and science literacy, and these things equate to problems in health literacy. And for me, the bigger challenge is this is our electorate. These are people who, you know, are going to the polls and helping to make decisions. So there's a warning shot that Carl Sagan put out a few years back. Society today relies on science and technology that almost no one understands. The combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces. So not on a negative note, but on a positive note that I think we can make a change by telling stories and sharing the science that we come to know and love. Thank you for your attention.